today, our interview is on Is There More to Life Than Success? And for that, we've got Ben Stone with us, who is from Massachusetts Financial Services. You might know it as MFS. He's a global equity portfolio manager, and he manages $30 billion in assets. So as we can all see, he's a good person to speak to about success, and we're really grateful that he's taken out some time to share with us today. But before I invite him up, let me just draw your attention to a quotation from the Bible, which has been really significant in Ben's life. It's there printed on the handouts on your tables, and it's taken from a letter written in 57-58 AD to some Christians who lived in Italy and Rome. If you'll allow me just to read it to us. It says, "Therefore, I urge you, brothers and sisters, in view of God's mercy, to offer your bodies as a living sacrifice, holy and pleasing to God. This is your true and proper worship." Now, you might notice that this comes from chapter 12 in the letter. And so to give the briefest summary of the first 11 chapters, you could say they're all about God's mercy, about his kindness. So Christians have received a huge, huge amount from God, and they did nothing for him, but just received from him. They received forgiveness and life forever. That said, it's not that Christians aren't meant to change. And here it's quite strong, isn't it? These first century Christians are being urged to remember God's kindness, so that they live in a very countercultural way. What are they being urged to do? To offer their bodies as a living sacrifice. And I guess this sounds pretty strange to most of us. We're not used to making bloody sacrifices. But back in the first century, they were, and they offered killed animals for various different gods. So the author of the letter was actually using this image to help the people then to understand what it meant to live for God. Animal sacrifices, when they were given, were burned up or killed. They were fully given over, fully dedicated to their God. And so the idea of a living sacrifice is kind of using that image to show us that every day Christians belong completely to God. They're to live completely for him in all the ways that they want to, sure, and also in all the ways that they don't want to. So even when it's hard, when it's uncomfortable, or when God's ways are different from their own. So it's in this sense that they're called to live sacrificially for God. Anyway, I'm sure we'll hear more from this, and more on this from there. So Ben, if you'd like to come and join me, and we'll hear more about you and your day job as well.
Thank you.
Thanks so much for coming in today. And for those of us who don't know, please can you tell us a little bit, what is equity management and how did you get to where you are today?
Thank you, Juliet. So, is this on? Everyone can hear? Yeah. So I work for the world's largest asset management firm that no one has ever heard of, MFS. So if anyone's heard of it here, I'll be very surprised and amazed. But I started off in the city in 96, worked for Schroders, and then by the end of 9 years, God had really blessed my time there as a Christian, and there are Christians on every single floor, and I was headhunted by MFS to come and work at MFS, and I was grilled for about 17, 18 different interviews, and my final interview was the hardest of the lot, and I was just really grilled non-stop for an hour. And at the end of that interview, Marcus sort of said, "Oh, Ben, by the way, I'm a Christian. There's no one in the London office who's a Christian. I've been praying for the London office and your boss for years and years and years. I think you should go there." And so I ended up there and was an investment analyst for a few years, and then ended up managing a global equity portfolio. Now, that's your question I'm getting to. So that essentially means that individuals or pension funds or governments or corporates sort of entrust me with their money, and my job is to look at the sort of 10,000 possible companies that I could invest in around the world and try and find the best sort of 100 or 150 to invest our clients' money in. And so it means, because I have to cover every sector, every country, every stock, I know a little bit about absolutely everything, The only problem is I don't know about anything in any particular at all. So I can sort of hold a conversation for about two sentences on any company, but dig any further and I'm sort of floundering around. I don't know what I'm talking about. So that's essentially what I do. Well, if you wanted your own separate segregated account, you'd need to have 100 million. But if you're willing to sort of stick it in a pooled vehicle, then, you know, I'll take whatever you've got. My life growing up was sort of very sort of mundane, sort of boring, undynamic, but loving sort of middle class sort of existence. I grew up in Cambridge, my parents were great, not Christians, but great and very loving. And I think they sort of realised that if I went to the sort of local sort of state school, I'd be bored and get into a lot of trouble. So they actually sold their house to send me to a private day's boys' school, which was very academic, and which probably sort of fueled a lot of very sort of selfish, worldly ambition in me. But it's a great school to go to.
Thank you. So, what were kind of your hopes and dreams then as you were growing up?
I think probably to try and make as much money by doing as little as possible.
Brilliant. And did that change at any point?
Yes, thankfully it did. I travelled in my year off in India with some Christian friends from school who were actually out there working in a Christian school. In South India, and they faithfully shared the gospel with me, and I absolutely hated it. So, and it's particularly one verse, John 14:6, when Jesus said, "I am the way, the truth, and the life. No one comes to the Father except through me." And in India, surrounded by hundreds of millions of Muslims and Hindus and Buddhists, I just thought, how supremely arrogant, which it is. If it isn't true. And so it really sparked something in me, and I went along to Durham to do my degree. But instead of doing my degree, I spent more time trying to disprove Christianity in a very arrogant, very aggressive, very obnoxious, self-important way. And so I'd go along to Christian Union meetings and stand at the back and cause problems and that kind of thing. So.
Okay. And it sounds like there's more to the story, so how was it that you came to trust in Jesus?
One of these particular meetings, a lovely guy came up to the end, and instead of sort of, you know, shouting at me for being so rude, was just really loving and kind and respectful and polite, and said, "Ben, it's really lovely to have you here, thank you for challenging us. You might want to think about this, or you might want to think about that," and so I got to know him a bit, and then he sort of said, "Well, why don't we get together every week, and one week you can choose an issue that really irritates you and annoys you about Christianity, and we'll look at that, and the next week I'll choose something." And so we did this week by week by week, and he's given me loads of books to sort of read, and by the end of that first year at Durham, I was intellectually convinced that Jesus had died and risen again, so he was God, and so I should listen to him. But even though it was so blindingly obvious to me now and to everyone else around me, I was still completely blind to my sin and my need of a saviour. So I tried to become a Christian, and it was the most miserable experience of my life, because there was no forgiveness, there was no joy, there was no salvation, I was dead, I hadn't been born again. And so after trying for a bit, I just sort of gave up and thought, this is just miserable, because it was. And it was only a couple of years later, after I had applied to come to the city to try and earn as much money, doing as little work as possible, after leaving Durham, before coming to the city, that I was converted travelling in South America. And I think, I don't know if anyone, has anyone been to Bolivia here? Anyone know Bolivia? So half of Bolivia is on this flat plateau of land. It's called the Altiplano. It's over 4,000 metres. Means the night skies are incredible. Colours were amazing. Salvador Dali did loads of his painting there because it's just so surreally beautiful. And yet everywhere you went, you could see mankind making a mess of this incredibly beautiful creation that the Lord had given us. And it was like the Lord holding up this big visual aid to me and sort of saying, look, Ben, you're making a mess of the life that I've given you. But I knew enough of the gospel from my time at Durham to know that he wasn't just waiting and willing, but he was longing for me to turn around and to say sorry and to ask for forgiveness. So I became a Christian and then ended up in the city 4 weeks later.
That's amazing. Thank you so much for sharing. So you just become a Christian, you ended up suddenly working in the City of London. How were early days as a Christian? How did you find sort of the interaction between work and religion?
It really was the ignorant, passionate zeal of the new convert. And I was thinking, Lord, what on earth am I doing here? You know, I've become a Christian. Why am I in the city? I shouldn't be here. I should be off evangelizing the whole world, which I absolutely don't have the gifts for. But that's what I thought at the time. And I was spending so much of my time evangelizing the whole office that I was actually not doing my job properly. And so I was being a really bad witness. And I was hauled up at the end of my first year and given a right ticking off because I was just not doing my job properly. But I was always planning my exit from the city and just thinking, Lord, I shouldn't be here. I should be off doing something really, really worthwhile.
Okay, so but you're still in the city many years later. So what changed? What made you see the value of, I guess, making money? And how is that different? Your original hopes and dreams
so I think it was just over a process of 2-3 years, maybe, that the Lord started to sort of humble me slightly and sort of help show me that I don't have those gifts to go off and be an evangelist or a full-time Bible teacher. I think my last ever sermon I gave here on Psalm 73. And I thought it was terrific. No one else really thought so. Actually, it's still on the St. Helens sort of library. You know, I didn't sort of explain Psalm 73 at all. It really should be wiped off, but I haven't told anyone about it, so please don't pass that on. But I wasn't getting any sort of feedback. No one was saying, Ben, you really should be a full-time Bible teacher. And at the same time, the Lord was giving me loads of opportunities for the gospel in the city. And so I think showing me, well, actually, no, some people do need to stay in the city and be ambassadors for Christ and be sharing the gospel in the city. And also, I think just starting to realize, well, actually, Ben, if being in the city goes well, you could end up partnering with multiple Bible teachers. So actually supporting men and women who are far more gifted and better at it than you are, so you can have a much bigger impact if you stay and partner with the gospel. And so those things were becoming sort of clear, and I think after about 4 years, 5 years, I just thought, okay, Lord, you know, my life is not my own. Came back to the verse, you know, we've been bought at a great price, we are living sacrifices, surrender my life to the Lord. Lord, please just use me in a way that will have the biggest impact for you, where I can be of most use to you. And I will gladly stay in the city if that's what you'd like me to do. So that was probably back in about 1999. So, yeah, I'm still here.
That's wonderful to hear how God turned you around, even though obviously you were still doing the same job throughout. You entered with quite a different perspective.
Yeah.
And continued. That's great. And I guess the last 20 years or so, we've seen quite a cultural shift, and being a Christian in the workplace is becoming more and more counter-cultural. Sometimes we even feel unpopular if we're following Jesus. So what motivates you to keep going personally as a Christian in the office?
I mean, I think in many ways it's becoming harder, but I think in many ways it's becoming easier to be a Christian in the workplace. And I've had sort of numerous scrapes as a Christian in the workplace over the years. It's quite funny ones. But I don't think HR would dare to treat me the way today, the way that I have been treated in the past. I think they're much more sort of sensitive and they think, oh no, I probably need to be a bit sort of careful here and can't just sort of bash him over the head for being a Christian. So What motivates me to keep going? Well, I think just the opportunities to reach out with the gospel. I mean, I think, the key is to keep seeing not just ourselves through God's eyes, that we are living sacrifices, we belong to Him, we are His, but keep seeing others, our colleagues, through the Lord's eyes as well. And whilst, our colleagues' greatest needs might be like they need a holiday or a rest or a different boss or a different job or anything, no, their biggest need is Jesus. And actually today, they're one day closer to meeting Him in judgment than they were yesterday. And I do picture that last day, and I don't know whether it's going to be like this or not, I have no idea, but this is what I sort of picture, in that, you see your colleagues on the day of judgment, and they turn to you and they say, well, Ben, you knew that this was going to happen, and you didn't care enough for me to at least warn me. And so, before I left Schroeder's, I wanted everyone in the firm to have a chance to at least hear something about Jesus. And so I organized carol services here for everyone at Schroeder's, and I wrote a little evangelistic booklet and gave that to everyone at Schroeder's, and I want the same to be true for MFS as well.
I guess that's quite a different hopes and dreams you have for the future compared to what you started out as. It's a lovely reward. So yeah, thank you so much for sharing. I think we're going to take a little break now. It would be great to ask Ben questions maybe about his faith, his journey, his work. So just maybe turn around the tables. You can submit questions on Friday if you'd like, or just get them ready and feel free to chat with them. We'll be back in a couple of minutes. Okay, well, let's come back to you. Thank you for your questions on Friday. I'd just like to keep starting with asking, when you were a student, you said you didn't become convinced that Jesus had died and risen again. And I guess from in a culture where we're more materially driven, what was it that convinced you that, I guess, the impossible had actually happened in Jesus' life?
I think just it was the most reasonable explanation, really. Looking at the internal evidence in the Bible, looking at the external evidence, so whether it's Tacitus or Josephus or some of the other sort of non-Christian writers at the time, but also just the impact that Jesus' resurrection had on his followers. I mean, it's extraordinary. If you were going to sort of found a movement or a church, would you have chosen that small group of essentially fishermen? I don't know, but for them to go from deserting Jesus to being the founders of the church, and we're pretty sure that all but one of them gave their lives for Jesus, and that's quite compelling evidence that they that Jesus really did die and rise again. And I love it in 1 Corinthians 15, where Paul is gathered and just sort of says, if Jesus didn't rise again, our faith is completely worthless and useless. And if you don't believe me, most of the people, of the 500 witnesses who saw him are still alive, so go to Jerusalem and ask them. So I think it's just very, very compelling, the most reasonable explanation.
Thank you. And actually, that's a question for any one of these books that we have on the table, just assuming it's all about we believe Easter really happened. Moving on to a question from Sion, what led you to finally surrender your will to God and stay in the city, and what did you go through to get to that stage?
Well, I don't know about you, but my default setting is I'm in charge, I know best. And I think it's, the Lord is very gracious in how He deals with us, and that He doesn't sort of show us everything wrong with our hearts and our attitudes in one go. Otherwise, we would be crushed. But in the Lord's time, over months and years, He puts His finger on different aspects of your life. And I think you've heard from my testimony that I didn't sort of lack confidence growing up, and I was certainly very arrogant. And I think the Lord slowly showed me some humility, and just actually I needed to, you know, to I didn't know what was best in my life, and to hand my life completely over to Him. He's sovereign. He's good. He knows what He's doing, and to trust Him. I think it's a great question, and it's a constant battle. I've been very, very, very fortunate indeed. It's a very, very blessed through my work. I think just reminding myself that it isn't my money. It is the Lord's money. It is all His, and I'll be held accountable for it. And actually, when I moved from Schroders to MFS, I was aware that the upside was potentially very, very, very material indeed. And so we sat down at that point 19 years ago and thought, well, it's all the Lord's money. We would keep a certain amount back of the bonus each year, and then just automatically give the rest away into a Christian charitable trust. And, you know, that's what we've done. But despite that, you know, we're still getting the tax back on that every year. And so it's very material. But it is just that reminder that actually it is all His. It is all a gift and of His. It's His grace to us. And it's all to be used for Him. I mean, we live in a fabulous house, which we try and use generously for the gospel, but it is just ours for a little bit. It's on loan to us, for us to use for Him and for His glory. So just try and keep that perspective.
Yeah, thank you. We've got a couple of questions about how we share the gospel with us at Signal office. So have you got any practical tips to what it's about sharing with the boss, the peer, or junior colleague? And kind of linked to that, how do you approach the question of timing? Would you create an opportunity for the new joiner as soon as they come, or do you kind of wait a bit?
That's a great question. I mean, I think that start by praying, and the constant prayer that I've prayed over these last 28 years is, Lord, I don't know who you want to be at work in. Please, will you just bring them across my path? And so just pray. And, you know, I'm constantly getting it wrong. I mean, there was a guy at work at MFS I'd invited to every single event for 10 years. And he hadn't just said, no, I'm sorry, I'm busy. No, he just said, no. No, no, no. And then after 10 years, he said, listen, can we go out for lunch? I said, yeah, sure, that's fine, Peter. And he said, now, I've been reading the Bible and these are my questions. I mean, I could have almost fallen off my chair. I couldn't believe it. And so, but what I try and do is I just try and, with male colleagues, just say to them, look, would you please, can I just take you out for coffee? Will you give me 20 minutes of your time? And I would just love to look at the first few verses of the gospel with you. It's a one-off. We'll just do it once. Never have to do it again. It's just a one-off. And just pray. And I keep it really short. And I'm just praying that there'll be something in those first two or three verses of John's Gospel, they'll go, goodness me, I had no idea it said that, or that was the claim about Jesus. And, you know, over the years, quite a few have said no, they wouldn't come for coffee. Quite a few have come for coffee, really enjoyed it, and then not wanted ever to meet again. But there have been a number of guys who've just sort of said, actually, can we meet again? And, you know, and the Lord has converted a number of colleagues, both at Schroders and at MFS, just as they have met Jesus in the gospel. And it's such a privilege. It's so exciting. You know, you're just there opening a gospel, and it's like you've got a ringside seat observing the Lord work powerfully and dramatically in these guys' lives, turning their lives upside down, bringing them from death to life, and then seeing their lives transformed. I mean, it is so thrilling. It is such a privilege. So, sorry, I'll stop.